Now, I didn't learn anything from the writing of my life story. And the reason I didn't learn anything from it is because I already knew everything I had written down, so I learned nothing new from that. And as I look back today, I realize 95% of my life story really doesn't have anything to do with my drinking anyhow. And the fact that I was born in 1929, I don't think it's got a thing in the world to do with my alcoholism. It may have with some other people's alcoholism, but not mine. The fact that I graduated from high school at age 17, I don't think that's got a thing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I went into service immediately after high school, I don't think that's got anything to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was married at age 21, I don't think that's got a thing to do with it. But I tell you what it did do. The 95% that had nothing to do with it very effectively covered up the 5% that did. And I could see nothing in my life story to contribute to my alcoholism other than the fact that I just drank a lot of whiskey. So again, in our confusion, then, since the life story didn't work, somebody in Minneapolis, Minnesota wrote a 4-step inventory guide. And we took the Minneapolis guide, we combined it with the big book, and we got more confused yet. Somebody in Dallas, Texas wrote a 4-step inventory guide. We took the Dallas guide, we combined it with the Minneapolis guide, combined it with the big book, and we got more confused yet. I have no idea how many of them's floating around today. We saw one that had 20 pages in it. And I'll guarantee you, if you wasn't crazy as hell before you took it, you would be when you were through with it. It was one of those. And all the time, the directions have been here in the book. We just never did see them before. And the reason we couldn't see them before is we never understood how Bill writes. But slowly over a period of years, studying his writings, working with his writings, we begin to see him develop certain traits. One thing we've seen already all the way through the book is he loved to take something that we already know about and use that as an example to teach us something new. We saw him do it with a great ocean liner and various other places. The other thing that we've seen Bill do all the way through the book is he loves to repeat himself, but he always uses a different word that means basically the same thing when he repeats himself. Now, if we can keep those two ideas in mind, I think we'll be able to see the directions here on this page 64 as to how to work this step. And I think we're going to be able to see that there's nothing in it at all to be afraid of. There's nothing in it to make it complicated. And I think we're going to see that it's a relatively simple thing to do if we will follow the directions in the book. So the first thing we have to do is just kind of sit back and relax. Start looking at a few words, and let's see how Bill starts with the giving us of the directions on the taking of the inventory.
Okay, followed at once by a strenuous effort to be rid of things in ourselves that have been blocking us. Now this is an effort to get rid of things that have been blocking us from God. Well, this is a decision we just made. Well, there are some things that are block us from that decision. So we have to get down to the causes and conditions of these things. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step 4. Now, he immediately leaves that and he goes to talking about another. He says, a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke.
Now I think right here is his first comparison. Mm-hmm. He's going to make a comparison between the personal inventory and a business inventory. Now let's say you own a business. And I don't care what it is. It's selling ladies' purses, Ben's watches, bicycles, whatever. If you didn't inventory in that business, and to inventory means to go in to the store and make a written list of items.
Yeah.
If you didn't inventory in that business once in a while to see what's in there, you wouldn't know what's been stolen out of the store that you didn't get paid for. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's been sold and you need to reorder so you'll have some goods to put in place of those items that were sold. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's become damaged and unsaleable. And people don't want to buy damaged goods. And they're sitting there in your store taking up valuable floor space and shelf space day after day after day. Nobody wants to buy them. You can't sell them. You're not making any money out of that. Eventually, you would go broke. If you didn't inventory once in a while, you wouldn't know what's become out of style. And people don't want to buy out-of-style goods. And if you got those out-of-style goods in the store, you need to inventory them. You need to put them on sale so people will buy them. You need to get them out of there so you could put good items in stock. I think it's quite easy to see if you had a business and you didn't inventory once in a while, you would probably go broke. Okay, I think his first comparison is this. In our personal lives, we have a business also. And the business in our personal life is the most important business in the world to us. And it's the business of finding a way to live so we can have a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness and sobriety at the same time. And if we don't inventory in our personal business, we're probably going to go broke too. And going broke to us is simply to go back to drinking. So I think his first valid comparison is whether you're dealing with a business inventory or a personal inventory, in either case, we'll go broke without an inventory. Now he's going to tell us how to take a business inventory. And when he's through with it, he is then going to say, I want you to do the same thing in your life that I just told you to do in the business inventory. So to do in our personal life, our personal business, the first thing we're going to have to do is see what he has to say about the business inventory. Now what we've done in order to help understand this, we've taken a little sheet and we've put on one side of that sheet business inventory and we've put on the other side of that sheet personal. Now, Joe right now is covering up both sides of it. And we're going to take some key words out of the big book. And the first thing we're going to do is list them under business. He said, taking a commercial inventory. Now, Dad Burnham, he could have said business again. But he's not going to use the same words twice in a row, so we'll call it a commercial this time instead of a business, meaning the same thing. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding, and we're putting the words fact-finding under business up here on the screen. And a fact-facing process, and we're putting the words fact-facing under business up here on the screen. It is an effort to discover the truth, and we're putting truth up here on the screen. About the stock in trade, and we're putting stock in trade up here on the screen. Now the stock in trade, that's the items we have in the store that are for sale. That's the ladies' purses, the men's watches, the bicycles, or whatever. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods. And we're putting damaged or unsaleable goods up here on the screen. To get rid of them promptly and without regret. And we're putting promptly and without regret up here on the screen. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. Now, once in a while, he'll try to fool himself. He'll say, well, the reason the ladies aren't buying these purses is they just don't understand what they need. He doesn't want to admit he's made a mistake. He made the decision to put them in there. And if he does that and they stay in there, every day they stay there, they're costing him money. They're taking up valuable floor space, shelf space. He's probably paying interest on borrowed money. So he's going to have to be truthful and not fool himself about his values. Now, is there anybody in here that would have any problem with that statement that Bill just made about a business inventory? We're going to try to find the facts. And when we find them, we're going to try to face the facts. We're trying to discover the truth about the stock in trade. And when we find it, we're going to disclose those damaged and unsaleable goods. Now, the good items in the store is not going to cause us to go broke. The damaged and unsaleable goods are what's going to cause us to go broke. And when we find them, we're going to get rid of them promptly and without regret. We're going to get them out of the store. And then when we open up new floor spaces and shelf spaces, we can put new items in, but we can't do that till the old items come out. So what we're really trying to do is find and remove the stock in trade that is damaged. Anybody got any problem with that at all? Okay, watch him. He said we did exactly the same thing with our lives. In other words, he wants you and I in our lives to do just what he told us to do right now in the business inventory. Now, in step four, he used a series of words that tells us what to do, which are almost identical to these that he used in the business inventory. He said, we made a searching, and we're putting searching straight across from fact-finding. They basically mean the same thing, to find the facts, to search out the facts. We made a searching in fearless, and we're putting fearless straight across from fact-facing, to fearlessly face those facts, to look at them as they really are. We made a searching in fearless moral, and there's where we got in trouble. We said, oh, crap. There it is. There's that list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. And we don't want to look at them. We sure to ourselves don't want to show them to anybody else. Now, I'm not sure what all Bill Wilson knew. But I know one thing. This guy understood the English language. And I really believe that if he had wanted you and I to make a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items, I think he would have said, we made a searching and fearless amoral or immoral inventory. And he didn't say that. He said moral. And this bugged me and bugged me and bugged me. Until one day we went back to the dictionary. And you know what moral means in the dictionary? It means truth. It means things as they really are. It means the right and wrong of any given situation. Exactly the same thing as truth. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of what? Of ourselves. We're the only stock in trade we have in this business of staying sober. Nobody else can make us sober. And nobody else can make us drink. Oh, I'll agree they can make us thirsty once in a while. But they can't make us drink. We decide whether we're going to drink or not. Now, what part of us decides whether we're going to drink or not? Is it our body or is it our mind? The real problem, the alcoholic, centers in the mind rather than the body. So as I make this searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, what I'm going to be looking for is the flawed thinking processes that block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And as long as those flawed thinking processes are in my mind, then God's thinking can't come in there. I'm going to have to make room for God's thinking. And the only way I can make that room is to get those flawed thinking processes out of there. And the only way I can get them out of there is to look at them. So my damaged and unsaleable goods in my mind, the flawed thinking processes, I'm going to try to find them. And when I find them, then I'm going to get rid of them promptly and without regret. Now there are three basic flawed thinking processes that block God out of the mind. And we've already looked at them when we talked about the basic instincts of life that create self. We said there were three wrongs that comes from living a life on self-will. and they're very easy to spot. And they are resentment, they are fear, and they are guilt and remorse associated with the harms we've done in the past. Now, if we can look at those honestly, truthfully, and if we can see where they actually come from, and if we can see how to remove them, and if we can see how to keep them from coming back in the future, then and then only can God enter our mind and begin to direct our thinking. You see, this is a job I have to do. Before I can give self-will back to God, I've got to clean it up. And I've got to get rid of those things that block me off from God. Now, I like to look at my mind up here as a little bitty store. Just a little bitty store, not much. Not even as big as this general store that's over here across the street. Much smaller than that. And in one part of my store, I've got some display cases. And those display cases are filled with resentments. Damn him. Damn her. And by God, I'll show them. And they're not going to treat me that way. And bloody, bloody, blah, blah, blah. God can't get in there. Those cases are already full. Over here at this side of my store, I've got a file cabinet. And it's filled with fear. Oh, my God. What's she going to do when she finds out? Oh, my God. Is that really my car sitting out there with the front end torn up? And I don't remember how. Oh, my God. What's the banker going to say when that check gets in there? Oh, my God. If I have to face the boss again? God can't get in that file cabinet. It's already filled up. Back here in the back of my store, I've got a storage room. And it's filled with guilt and remorse associated with the people I've hurt in the past. Even if they haven't caught me, I'm still filled with guilt and remorse because God dwells within me. I know the difference between right and wrong. God can't get in that room. It's already full. Now, if I want God to direct my thinking, I'm going to have to take those flawed thinking processes and do something about their removal. And when they are removed, then God can enter my store and begin to direct my thinking, and we will then be changing the stock in trade. He said we did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly, morally, truthfully. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease, for we've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When a spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically.
Thank you.
Now, I can only be sick in one of three ways. I can become physically ill. And for my physical illness, I usually go to an MD. And the MD, with their knowledge and their expertise, will read the symptoms coming from my physical illness. And from those symptoms, they will diagnose the problem, prescribe, and hopefully I get well. I can also be mentally ill. For that, I go to a psychiatrist. My mental illness will display certain symptoms. The psychiatrist will read the symptoms, diagnose, prescribe. Hopefully I get well. The only other way I can be sick now is to be spiritually ill. And a spiritually ill person is one who is blocked from God and cannot receive God's will and God's power in their life. It also displays certain symptoms. And they are resentment, fear, guilt, and remorse. And resentment is the killer for we alcoholics. So my book is getting ready to show me in a very simple way how to look at these resentments, how to see the truth about them, how to get rid of them, and then the greatest thing of all, how to keep them from coming back in the future. And this thing is so simple that we absolutely can't understand it. The only thing we can do is do it and get the results, and then we'll understand it. So if we're going to have to look at resentments first, then maybe we better talk just a little bit about what is a resentment. Joe, another word that we need to understand.
Resentment. What is a resentment? We always talk about having them, and she's got one, and he's got one. But what does this word mean to us? What is resentment? When we look at the word itself, on the front of the word, re, whenever we see that on a word, re means again, the second time, again. Like repeat, replay, redo, re, it's the second time. And it comes from a Latin word, sentire. And I say, be careful with my Latin, because I speak soul Latin, which is not too good.
Mid-Arkansas soul Latin.
Okay. Sentire, which means to feel. So it really means to feel again. And looking at the scheme of things, and looking back itself, because that's the root of our problem. You know, everyone has self. Every human being has basic instincts and desires that motivate them. That the ones that we talked about in step three. Not only do I have self, every other individual, standard equipment, everybody's got a set up.
Everybody's got the same basic instincts of life.
And one of their instincts, maybe their desire for companionship, or their desire for security or sex, or one of their basic instincts get out of control. And it happens to all people. And they do something sometimes that strikes me, and it hurts. It strikes one of my basic instincts. That's the way. And so, when they do, then that's a wrong on their part. That's a wrong on their part. That's not a resentment.
Maybe they do something to threaten our self-esteem.
That's right. Say something that hurts my self-esteem.
Or threaten our security. They rip our money off. Or threaten our sex life. It's a wrong when they do that to us.
That's right.
That's not a resentment. That's a wrong on their part. Yeah.
But I had a bad habit when that would happen. Once they did it the first time, I would go in the next room and replay that. You know, I would stand there and go through it all in my mind, let it happen all over again, and allow that hurt person to hurt me the second time. Now, I would blame that one on him, too. He didn't do but one, but I put that second one. He'd blame that one on him. And I didn't know it, but, you know, I ain't too honest a person. I'd go home and replay it again and then add a little more something to it. And every time I'd play it over, I'd make him a little worse and myself a little more innocent.
And the pain just a little bit deeper.
Deeper, yeah. And after a period of time, a few days of playing that, it didn't even resemble what really happened. But you know, and it wasn't the truth by that time. But we human beings don't operate off the truth, ever. None of us know the truth. Only God knows the truth. We operate off of our perspectives of the truth, what we think the truth is. We don't know the truth. And with this resentment, I can distort, and I'm operating off of something that's not true. Because the more I play it over, the worse it gets. You know, I always, I think it is a football season, and we always talk about this, and this is when, sometimes you're watching a football game, and life is just like a football game. You know, in a football game, you're going to get hit. That's the name of the game. I mean, they're going to hit you, right? You're going to get hit in life. But we will see a guy on the football field, he gets hit, and sometimes he gets knocked out, and they have to call a timeout and come in there and pump some more air into him, right? I get him up. Usually he goes back in the game of life. It's like we go back in the game of life. The game goes on.
Now, you can tell he got hurt. You can see the expression of pain on him.
That's right.
You can see his arm bend back and his leg bend back, and you can tell that he was hurt.
Yeah, but you can see it, yeah. But then they'll announce that he's got a resentment machine up there. You know, he ain't satisfied. I said, let's look at that again. And he turns on his resentment machine.
In slow motion.
And it slows it down, right? Gets a good close-up.
Living color.
And this time you can see this guy's leg go way back. It looks a lot worse the second time. Right? Yeah. Now the games, they back playing the game. He's still showing this. Oh, every time he shows it, it gets worse. That's what the alcoholic does. He gets up every morning, turns on his replay machine.
We've got up here in our head a little resentment recording machine up here.
Cleans the lens off every morning and gets it ready.
Tunes it up in living color.
That's right. And he shines it on the world all day. Now, he don't want no good stuff. He like that 6 o'clock news. He wants that bad stuff, right? Then he comes home and replays it, makes himself sick, and blames it on them, right? Now, some days he has a bad day. Now, bad days is when they won't do nothing to him. That's a bad day.
Got his machine tuned up, got it shining all day
and
long.
And won't nobody do nothing to him, right?
Bad day for an alcoholic.
Bad day for an alcoholic. Now, on those days, you know what he does? He records what they're thinking. I know what they're thinking. He's a mind reader, yeah. Drunk mind readers. And we laugh at it, but it is just that stupid. I mean, it is just that stupid. You know, we have a resentment. We're replaying something that's happened. You know, we are not running our lives. God cannot direct our lives. We're effectively blocked from God. Our lives are being directed by the thing that we resent, the person or thing that we resent. They are directing our lives. And then probably one of the worst emotions, you know, resentment never goes, we never have one until it doesn't come back home. It's like a boomerang, like Bill's boomerang. It goes out and it comes back. Because as soon as you resent someone else for what they did, then you resent yourself for being in that position to even allow that to happen. And that's become self-pity. Now, we love that one.
Self-pity is about the sickest sick a human being can
be.
That's
right, when he resents himself. And we alcoholics love self-pity. Some days we wake up and don't have enough of it, we feel bad, you know. You know, if you want to make an alcoholic mad, try to feel sorry for him. He tell you, that's my damn job, you can't have that. But, so what we're going to do is, we're going to analyze, and he uses a word in the book. We heard, you know, here around the fellowship, people even, many different things they say. We ain't talking about the fellowship. But around the fellowship, they say don't analyze, utilize. Very peculiar. Our book does say we are going to analyze these resentments. Okay? Analyze means to get down to the truth. Okay? And the truth will set us free from these resentments. So this is a process of analyzing them, getting down to the causes and conditions of these flawed thinking processes, and get them out of our minds. And then we can see, once we take our lives back from other people that we resent, then God can direct our lives so we can carry out the decision that we made in step 3.
You know, Joe says if we throw these resentments out there long enough, sooner or later they turn right around and come right back at us.
Okay.
They come back at us as self-resentment. And after a while, that turns into self-pity.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons we alcoholics love that self-pity is we can get up in the morning, we can put that self-pity on as a cloak of dignity, and we can say, here I come, mean old world, just do it to me. I know you're waiting on me out there. I think it's a sick, sick way for us to build our ego.
Yeah.
Because after all, if you're important enough that the whole world's picking on you, you must really be somebody. It's a sick, sick way to build ego and build self-esteem.
That's right.
And we roll around in that old sickness and that old self-pity, and there's no way that we can have any peace of mind, serenity, and happiness. No way can God direct our thinking, because our mind is filled with those resentments. And if I want God to take over that part of my mind, I'm going to have to do something about their removal. And here's the procedure we follow. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now that means we're going to have a sheet of paper. And I think one of the worst things about this inventory is the example on page 65, which is the paper where Bill set them down, is already filled out. And we didn't know the procedure that he followed to fill it out. So what we've done is we made up an inventory sheet, and we would ask you now to take the last two columns, fold them under where you can't see them. And if you'll do that, you'll be looking at columns 1, 2, and 3, and we want to emphasize this is not anything new. We've already got enough inventories in AA already. We don't need anything new. You'll see those three columns, and they are page 65 in the blank form. So this is nothing new whatsoever. The last two columns we'll use a couple pages later. Now here's his first instruction. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. Period. Stop right there. While our mind is on one thing and one thing only, let's take column one, let's start up at the top, and let's make a list of all the institutions, all the people, all the principles with whom we are angry. Just like Bill did on page 65. He listed Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, my employer, my wife. And if you'll notice, he left some space between each one of those names so he would be able to do a little writing over here in the second column after a while. So we could probably put on a standard sheet of paper maybe six names, maybe eight, leaving spaces like he does here. Now, we are taught as we grow up to read and write from left to right. But if you do that with the inventory, you confuse yourself. Because if you tried to put a name in column one, and then if you switch to column two to see the cause, you've got to change your thinking pattern to, well, what did they do to me? And then if you went to column three, you've got to try to think, well, now what part of self was affected? And then you go back to the second name, then column two and three, and after you do that about a dozen times, your mind just gets real raw. And after a while, you say, to hell with it. All they wanted was my life story anyhow, and you throw it away. But if you'll just do one column at a time, it's awful hard to get confused that way. And I've never seen an alcoholic yet that does not know just to who and exactly what by God they're mad at. Man, we spend thousands of hours sitting around in bars talking about it. All we got to do now is take it out of the mind, put it down on a sheet of paper. You don't have to be sober very long to do this. You don't have to have any high education to do this. If you can't write, you feed the names to somebody else and have them write them down for you. And as you finish up that first column, I hope you will realize something that I did. You notice Bill here just had four names. I assume he probably had more resentments, just didn't want to use any more space in the book. Probably you guys could get all of your resentments on one sheet of paper. But I found out I couldn't. They came to me and said, make a list of your resentments, and I said, I don't have any. And they said, oh, surely you do. Maybe you don't understand what a resentment is. Let us explain it to you. And they did. And I said, oh, yeah, I got a couple of those. They said, we'll put them down on paper. And I filled out on a sheet of paper about eight names. And I reached over and got another sheet, and I filled out about 8 more. And I got another sheet, and I filled out about 8 more. And somewhere I got up to about 165. I said, man, you matter in hell at everybody. I did not know that. You can only see one resentment at a time in your head. I don't think any of us will ever see how many resentments we really have, how much they control and dominate our thinking, until we put them all down on a sheet of paper for the first time. We've made a decision in step 3 to let God direct our thinking. And if we've got that many resentments, then there's no way God can direct our thinking, and I don't think we'll ever see it till we put them down on a piece of paper. So I've already learned a piece of valuable information just by filling out the first column. Joe?
Okay, now let's look at the next instruction. We asked ourselves why we were angry. We come to the second column. And we look at each name, and beside each name we write down the cause, why we were angry. We remember that too. If you hadn't remembered that, you wouldn't remember the name. Everybody, we remember that.
We not only know who we're mad at, but we know why we're mad at them too.
That's right. We fill out that column from top to bottom, looking at one thing, what did they do? We don't have to write out a great essay, you know, in detail. Just enough for us to know, and to know what really took place.
Let's look at Bill's example in column 2.
Yeah.
He's mad at Mr. Brown. Well, the cause, his attention to my wife. Told my wife and my mistress, Brown might get my job at the office. I don't blame him. I'd be mad at him too. Hell, I don't even know him, and I'm mad at him already. He's mad at Mrs. Jones. She's a nut. She snubbed me. She commended her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip. You know, she put his best drinking buddy in the state insane asylum. That's what she did. She had him put away. He's mad at the employer. Unreasonable, unjust, and overbearing. He probably said, Bill, where were you all day yesterday anyhow? He threatens to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account. Now that's unreasonable, isn't it? He's mad at his wife. She misunderstands and nags. She likes old Brown. And she wants the house put in her name.
Oh, boy.
You tie together like an old Brown wanting the house put in her name. It's about time to get a little upset here. Very carefully, in column 2, by the side of each name, with just a few words, we put down the cause. There may be one cause, there may be multiple causes. As I filled out the second column, I begin to see something. I begin to see it's really not the people and the institutions I'm upset with. It's what they do to me that's got me upset. What's turned out to be valuable to me is I'm getting ready to start out on a lifetime changing process. And I'm going to try to develop the best possible relationship that I can with the world and everybody in it for maximum peace of mind. And a part of that relationship is I'm going to ask these people later on to forgive me for what I've done. But at the same time, I'm going to have to forgive them for what they've done. And a part of that forgiving process can start right here. When I begin to see it's really not them that's got me upset. It's what they've done to me. Now, I can take Mr. Brown out of here and put Mr. Green in. And I'd be just as upset with Green as I would be with Brown if he did the same thing. I could take my wife out of here and put my mistress in, and I'd be just as upset with her if she does the same kind of stuff. And I begin to see it's not people. It's what they do that upsets me. That's going to be useful later on. It starts getting names out of the way. Now, we filled out two columns. We've learned something very valuable in both columns. First column is how resentful we really are and how much it blocks us from God. And the second column, we realize it's not them we resent, it's what they do that we resent. Now, let's look at the third instruction.
Okay, let's go to the third column. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, that's a social instinct, our pocketbook, our security, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened, So we were sore, we were burned up. He repeats these three instructions again on our grudge list, the first column. Obsidian's name, our injuries, the second column. The third column was its self-esteem, our security, our ambition, our personal, our sex relations, which had been interfered with. And we go to the third column, and we know we're looking at the basic instincts of life, which all people have, which we discussed in step three, which we say are the three basic instincts that make up self. You know, we cannot have a resentment unless one of these has been touched or endangered or hurt. And now we can look at the second column and develop the third column. By looking at the injury, what part of self did they injure? We don't even have to look at the name anymore. Just look at the second column and see what they did and see what did they hurt. Now we have an example. As we go over this example, Mr. Brownie's attention to my wife. What did that threaten? Well, it threatened his sex relations with his wife. If Brown gets messing around with his wife, it threatens his sex relations. Told my wife about my mistress and self-esteem. What are people going to think of me if Brown gets messing with my wife? Right? Told my wife about my mistress. Now, that'll really mess up your sex relations.
Wife cuts him home, and then she goes over and raises hell with a mistress, and he's cut off over there too. No sex relations
right.
left at all.
That's right. And boy, that'll really mess up your self-esteem. After all, you know, I'm a hard-working guy. You know, I go to Sunday school on Sunday morning. I go out with the Boy Scouts. I'm a leading citizen of the community. Now all this comes out about my wife and my mistress and all this. That boy's really hurt. That's hard on your self-esteem.
What's the neighbors going to think about us now?
That's right. You can ask old Jimmy Baker. He'll tell you about that one. Okay. Brown may get my job at the office. Well, that threatens my security instinct. Yeah, that's my job. That's my security. And my self-esteem. What are the people going to think about me when Brown undercuts me and gets my job? You cannot have a resentment unless one of your base instincts in life is threatened or endangered. Now, that's the root cause anyway of all of it.
As I begin to fill out the third column, I learned what I think has become the most valuable thing I've ever learned. For the first time in my life, I begin to see where anger comes from. I've always had a problem with anger. And I've always acted and reacted in anger, and I would do things that hurt people, and I would be sorry about it, and I'd say I'll never do it again, and next time I get angry, I turn right around and do it all over again. I never knew where anger comes from. I thought it was just one of those feelings that flitted into your mind. You could do nothing about it. You can't do anything about a problem till you understand the problem. For the first time in my life, I see anger comes from how I choose to react to a threat to one of my basic instincts of life. How I choose to react to a threat to one of my basic instincts of life. You know, this lady I'm married to, Barbara, some of you know her. Beautiful, beautiful lady today. If there's any such thing as a black belt Al-Anon, she's it. She got 28 years in the Fellowship of Al-Anon, got a great program. But once in a while, Al-Anons get sick too, himself. And sometimes she'll say or do something that threatens one of my basic instincts. And when she does that, it hurts. Maybe she puts me down and hurts my self-esteem. Or she says something about me in front of other people that hurts my self-esteem. Or she does something to threaten my security or my sex life. And when she does, that hurts. Now, I found that when that happens, one of two things is going to take place. If my basic instincts are under control, and my relationship with God that day is okay, I find I'm able to say, well, the poor old thing, they're sick just like all the rest of us, and they can't help it any more than we can. And that'll just slide off of my back, and it just won't bother me at all, and I go on about my business, and everything's okay. Now, 3 weeks from now, though, the same lady does the same thing. And this time, my basic instincts aren't under control. And my relationship with God that day is not right. And I react with anger. And I romp, and I stomp, and I raise hell with Barbara and everybody around me all day long. Now, the same lady did the same thing. But I chose to react to it in an entirely different manner, based upon my instincts and my relationship with God. Oh, I'm glad I've learned that. Because you see, I can't do anything about Barbara. And I can't do anything about other people. But with God's help, I can do something about my reaction to these things. And I don't have to get angry if I don't want to. And if I don't have to get angry, then I'm in much less chance of getting drunk than I would be otherwise. Today, when people do things that hurt me, the first thing I say is, God, I hope it's my fault. Because if it's my fault, I can do something about it. If it's their fault, I can't. You see, I didn't know any of that until I began to fill out this third column. Now, we're going to use a couple of examples just to kind of liven this deal up a little bit. We're going to put them up here on the screen, and I need a volunteer to write. That's all right. You can't be sloppier than I am. They couldn't even read mine if I put it up there. Okay, we're going to go to column one, and we're going to put down the first couple of names on my inventory sheet, and then we're going to take one from Joe's inventory sheet. Now, the first name on my sheet was a lady named Barbara, the one I'm married to today. She was number one on that list. I hated her with a purple passion when I got here. The second one on that list was the Internal Revenue Service. God, I hated those people. Now then, Joe, who was the first one on your list?
My mother-in-law.
My mother-in-law.
Boy, I resented her. Okay. It was bad, 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 you know. She lived in Kentucky, you know. And every time I seen a car with Kentucky license plates on it, just go all over again, you know.
So that's the way we fill out column one.
Every time I drove behind a car and seen a Kentucky license plate, I just had the resentment all over again.
Now let's go to the second column. Why was I so upset with Barbara? Well, she filed for divorce 3 times the last year before she went to Al-Anon. Let's just say 3 divorces. I used to lay awake at night thinking about this and worrying about what everybody thought about this. And I'd lay there and I'd think, by God, in the morning when she gets up and goes to work, now I hope she's driving down Highway 20 and one of those big semis will run over her. And I want it to be a company that had lots of money. Because I could get her killed and I could sue them and collect about $3 million at the same time. See, you Al-Anons are not the only ones that had those fantasies. We got them too. Why did I hate the Internal Revenue Service? Well, they were about to put me in jail, that's why. Put me in jail, that's the cause of it. Joe, how come you hated your mother-in-law so bad?
She broke up my marriage.
Broke up his marriage?
Definitely. I hate it.
You see, very simply we do that. Nothing complicated about that at all. Now let's go to the third column. Barbara filing for divorce 3 times within that 1 year, is that a threat to my self-esteem?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What are the neighbors going to think about this now? You know, they've been watching this stuff go on here for a year. Sure. Barbara filing for divorce, is that a threat to my personal relationships?
Yeah.
Certainly not only with her, but with my kids. You know, she's going to get the kids probably if she gets a divorce. Barbara filing for a divorce, is that a threat to my security?
Get the money.
You better bet it is. She's going to get it all before she's done.
Get that pocketbook.
Barbara filing for divorce, is that a threat to my sex life?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think she'll let me have any after the divorce.
It's gone.
Now let's go to the Internal Revenue Service. Them trying to put me in jail. Now, is that a threat to my self-esteem?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What's the neighbors going to think about this kind of deal, you know? Is that a threat to my personal relationships?
Yeah.
Certainly. I'm not going to really be able to have any relationships with Barbara and the kids if I'm in jail. Is that a threat to my security?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're going to find the hell out of me, and it's going to cost me a lot of money before this deal's all over with. Is that a threat to my sex life?
Yeah.
With the kind I like to have, it would be. there might be another one in there I don't want, but the kind I want would be a threat to it. Joe's brother-in-law breaking up the marriage. Is that a threat to his self-esteem?
Yeah.
Why, certainly it is.
Personal relationships.
A threat to his personal relationships? Sure, the wife and kids are gone now.
Yeah.
Is it a threat to his security?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's going to have to go to work now. That woman been supporting him for the last 2 years. Is it a threat to his sex? It's a threat to his sex life?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure it is.
She wiped me out.
Just almost wiped us out.
Didn't miss nothing. Didn't miss nothing.
That's how we fill out the three columns. Very, very simple. Thank you. Very easy to do. Now that we fill them out, let's see what we're going to do with them. Page 65, bottom of the page.
We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we finished, we considered it carefully. We begin to look at the first thing apparent. Was that the world and its people are often quite wrong. That's right, people, we knew that. That's no new information. To conclude with others was wrong as far as we ever got. As far as I ever got was the first column. I always kept them on my mind and replayed that over. The usual outcome of people continuing to wrong us and we stayed sore. This was right. Sometimes it was Morris, and then we were sore ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. I just built up more resentments. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. A moment of triumph was short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentments leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile?
And I read that and I stopped. I tried to look back in my life and see how much time I've squandered in resentments. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I know about me. And when I got a good resentment churning around in my head, I'm pretty well paralyzed from doing anything worthwhile. About all I want to do is just keep running that thing over and over and over and over in my head. And one of my favorite things that I used to do when I was drinking was to get up early in the morning, have a drink of whiskey and a cup of coffee, and turn on my replay machine and replay what she said to me yesterday and replay what he did to me last week and replay what they did to me a month ago and replay what that damn banker did a year ago and replay what that policeman did to me 5 years ago and replay what that neighbor said to me 8 years ago. And replay what my brother did to me 10 years ago. And replay what my mama did to me 15 years ago. And replay what my daddy did to me 20 years ago. And replay what my grandpa said 25 years ago. And it took me just about an hour to run through that tape. And I loved every moment of it. And when that tape would run out, I'd have another drink of whiskey and another cup of coffee. And then I would turn on my get-even machine. Now, by God, the next time she does that, I'll do this and she'll do that and she'll say that and I'll do this and I'll put it on her and they're not going to treat me that way. And it took me just about an hour to run through that tape. And I loved every moment of it. I have literally spent thousands and thousands and thousands of hours in resentments. And as far as I can tell, they didn't do me any good whatsoever. An absolute, complete waste of time. Now, when I got to AA, I found the only difference is I wasn't taking the drink of whiskey. I was getting up in the morning, having a cup of coffee, turn on the replay machine, run it for an hour, have another cup of coffee, turn on the get-even machine, run it for another hour, and I was wasting just as much time in sobriety as I was in drunkenness, as far as resentments are concerned. This is the first time in my life that I've ever been sober and really felt good at the same time. I didn't know you could be sober and feel good. I didn't know you could be sober and have the peace of mind, serenity, happiness, and excitement in your life that I've got today, and I love every moment of it. Now, I've only got so much time to live here on earth. And I've already spent most of mine here on earth. I've only got just a little bit of it left. And I'll be damned if I'm going to waste any more of what I've got in resentments. I love to feel good, and I'm going to feel good every moment for the rest of my life if I possibly can. Resentments are an absolute waste of time. They rob you of any peace of mind. They destroy your relationship with God, yourself, and other people. And they actually kill people like us. That's a bad, bad deal to waste your time when it could be used for something worthwhile. But that's not the worst thing. Here's the worst thing a resentment does to you.
But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For often harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die.
There's the main thing wrong with the resentment. When we are harboring a good resentment, we're effectively blocked off from God. And blocked off from God, we don't feel good. And we're going to feel bad just so long. And our mind will always remember that sense of ease and comfort that comes from a couple of drinks. Next thing you know, we start thinking about drinking. We become insane. We believe it's okay to drink. And then we end up drunk all over again. And for people like us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Always before, I would look at it to see what those suckers had done to me. Today, I look at it to see what that resentment is doing to me. And if it's blocking me off from God and it's going to get me drunk, then I'm looking at it from an entirely different angle. We begin to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. And I read that statement and I stopped and I said, Charlie, how stupid can you be? All my life, I've been proud of the fact that I stand on my own two feet. Nobody tells me what to do. I don't need your advice, thank you. And suddenly, I realized that other people, through my resentments toward them, have controlled how I think, and they've controlled my decisions, and they've controlled my life as far back as I can remember. When I'm resenting them, they're controlling the way I think. And if they're controlling the way I think, they're going to control my decisions and my actions, and they very effectively have controlled my life as far back as I can remember. All I've ever done is respond to those resentments. And I said, man, you really are dumb. Because some of these people have been dead and buried in the graveyard for years. And they've been reaching out from the grave and they've had me but a yang-yang as far back as I can remember. And when I saw that and saw what they were doing to me, I said, to hell with them. I'm not going to let those people live in my head rent-free any longer. I've made a decision to let God direct my thinking. And if other people, alive or dead, justified or unjustified, direct my thinking, then God can't. And it's just that simple. And I never knew that. And when I saw that, that looked so stupid to me, to let those people do that to me. And we alcoholics fancy ourselves as reasonably intelligent people. And we all like to look stupid. And I tell you what happened to me. That looked so stupid, about 95% of those resentments just disappeared automatically. God, they look good in your head. But wait till you put them on paper. Wait till you see what they're doing to you. It looks so dumb that about 95% of them are automatically going to disappear. Now, there may be 1, 2, 3, 4, though, that have been embedded in our minds so deeply for so long that we may have to have some help with that. We now come to the first prayer in the big book on step 4. You hear always about the stir prayers on 3 and 7. You never hear about the 4s. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol.
This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us would have spiritually sick, and this is true. Because when an individual won't hurt another person unless he's spiritually sick, one of his instincts gets out of whack. Though we did not like the symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. And we have prayer. We ask God to help us show them the same tireless pity and patience that would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offends, we say to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can it be helpful to him? God save us from being angry. Thy will be done. You know, if we have a resentment and we enter in communion with God in prayer about this resentment, you know, we go into love, which is basically a concern for another person's welfare. And it's totally impossible to pray for that person and resent him at the same time. One will overcome the other. We have a great example of that we usually use, and it's good. It's a fine example of it, of how to use prayer on resentments, in a story in the back of the book, page 551. It's a good illustration if we can go back and look at this. Is a great example of how this particular thing was used. Third paragraph. She says, I've had many spiritual experiences since I've been in the program. Many I didn't recognize right away, for I'm slow to learn and they take many guises. But one was so outstanding I would like to pass it on, whatever I can, and hope that it will help someone else as it has me. She says, as I said earlier, self-pity and resentment were my constant companions, and my inventory began to look like a 33-year diary, for I seemed to have resentment against everyone I'd ever known. She said, all but one responded to the treatment suggested in the steps.
Whenever she filled out those three columns,
yeah,
all of those resentments except one looked so stupid that they disappeared automatically. Now what'd she do with that one?
But this one posed a problem. She said, it was against my mother. And I love the way she works on this one. It was 25 years old. I had fed it, fanned it, and nurtured it as one might a delicate child.
Oh God, she loved this one.
It has become as much a part of me as my breathing. And here's why she needed it. It provided me excuses for my lack of education, my marital failures, personal failures, inadequacies, and of course my alcoholism. She blamed her mother on my alcoholism on her mother. And though I really thought I was willing to part with it, now I was reluctant to let it go. One morning I ever realized I had to get rid of it, for my reprieve was running out. And if I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk. I didn't want to get drunk anymore. In my prayers that morning, I asked God to point out me some way to be free of this resentment. During the day, a friend of mine brought me some magazines to take to a hospital group I was interested in. I looked through them, and a banner across the front of the one featured an article by a prominent clergyman in which I caught the words resentment. He said, in fact, if you have a resentment you want to be free of, if you pray for the person or thing you resent, you will be free. If you ask in prayers for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't really want it for them, your prayers are only words and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. Do it every day for 2 weeks, and you will find you have come to mean it and want it for them, and you will realize that where you used to feel bitterness, resentment, and hatred, you will feel compassionate, understanding, and love. You know, this is what prayer will always overcome resentment.
Have you ever seen anything more simple than this? 95% of them disappeared because they looked so stupid. The other 5% can be removed through prayer. And that means the damaged and unsaleable goods up here filling up my file cabinet have now been removed and the hole is opened up. Now, another natural law applies here, which says nature abhors a vacuum. No such thing as a vacuum or a void. Something's always rushing in to fill it up. God's not going to leave any more holes in my head. I've got enough already. If those resentments disappear, they're going to have to be replaced with something else. And the only thing that can replace them is the opposite of them. And where my mind used to be filled with resentment, now it's filled with love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill toward my fellow man. Oh, I'm in much less chance of drinking now than I was before I started the inventory process. Nothing negative here, a very positive happening. And you know what really amazed me? I found that in order to get love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill, I didn't have to go to any other fellowships. And I didn't have to read any other books. If God dwells within inside me, that's always been a part of my makeup. I could never use it before. In my chase for money, power, prestige, sex, what I thought were all the good things of life, those feelings had to be repressed to let me operate on the level I wanted to operate on. But now that resentment's gone, they automatically come to the surface. I have never seen anything like this. Changing the stock in trade. The damaged and unsaleable goods called resentments have been removed. New stock has taken its place. I'm in much better shape than I was before I started the inventory process. Now, I really don't understand why it works. I just know that it works. Now, let me tell you something. If you've got a resentment and you don't want to get rid of it, for God's sake, don't pray about it. Because if you do, it's going to disappear. I had one of those. One of those I was taken to the grave with me. There's no way I'm going to get rid of this resentment. I hated this guy. My God, I would have killed him in a minute if I could. And somewhere in this process, it began to bug me. And I went to my sponsor and told him about it. I never had told him about that before. And he said, "Oh, Charlie, you've got to get rid of that resentment." I said, "Man, I don't want to get rid of this resentment." He said, "That's beside the point. If you don't, it's going to kill you." And in my smart mouth manner, I said, "Okay, how am I going to do that?" And he said, "Go back here to page 551. Read this story and then go home and do what it says to do." And I read the story and I went home and I got on my knees and I said, "God, I want you to give that son of a bitch everything he deserves." That's the only prayer I had for him that day. The next day I prayed again, and the next day I prayed again, and somewhere after 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 days, I don't know when, I found myself saying something I didn't intend to say. I said, "God, give him in his life what I want in mine. Give him the same peace of mind, serenity, and happiness I seek for myself." And after three or four more days, I woke up one morning, and that resentment was completely gone, and it's never returned. And the irony in the whole situation is it wasn't 2 weeks and that guy moved in as my next door neighbor.
Yeah.
This thing works. But it would do me no good to get rid of these resentments if I didn't know how to keep them from coming back. God, the world's full of sick people. And they're going to do it to me again tomorrow if I'm not careful. And I can't have just one resentment. They're just like a pack of dogs. You kick one, they all jump up. When I get one resentment, then I got 2, 3, 6, 8, and 10. And I'm a basket case. I got to do one more thing for resentments. Let's unfold your last two columns. Let's go to page 67. And we'll go to the second paragraph. Referring to our list again. Now see, this is what you got. Well, you got to have a written resentment. This is twice we've had to refer to it. No. If you didn't have a written resentment, it'd already be gone. I mean, a written inventory, it'd already be gone. Some people try to take a mental inventory. It's impossible. Putting out of our minds the wrongs that others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. We've never done this before, have we? We've always looked to see what they've done, but we've never looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them, we placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. So I went back to the sheet. And now we need the volunteer again to do just a little more writing. And I looked at that first name on my sheet. And that's this lady named Barbara. And I said, now Charlie, do what your book tells you to do. Forget about Barbara filing for divorce 3 times. Just forget that entirely. What did you do, if anything, to set this thing in motion? To cause her to file for divorce in the first place? For instance, column 4 said, what did I do? Putting out of mind the wrongs others had done, I resolutely looked for my own mistakes. What did I do, if anything, to set in motion trains of circumstances which in turn caused people or institutions to hurt me and eventually led to my resentment of them for doing so? You remember how back in step 3, it said we invariably find that we made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. I said, now forget the 3 divorces. What did you do, if anything? And I said, well, if I hadn't been out there running around with other women, maybe she wouldn't have filed for divorce. I said, well, if I hadn't been sneaking around behind her back lying to her all the time, maybe she wouldn't have filed for divorce. I said, well, if I hadn't been spending all the money I was making on booze and all those things that go with it, maybe she wouldn't have filed for divorce. I said, you know, if I'd been a little more considerate of Barbara and my kids, maybe I wouldn't have been doing some of those things that caused her to file for divorce. For the first time in my life, I looked at me to see what I had done to create a problem for another human being. And when I saw what I had done, I suddenly realized, hell, no wonder I love resentments. Because you see, what I had done with Barbara is I had taken what she did to me, the filing for divorce 3 times. I had played it over and over and over in my head. And each time I played it over, I distorted the picture just a little bit. And each time I made what she did, the 3 divorces, a little bit stronger. And I made what I did just a little bit less. and let me play it long enough, eventually I'm able to stand there and say, well, I was just standing there doing nothing. And they come along and did it to me. You see, I had used my resentment to distort the truth and transfer all blame to her, and made myself as pure as the driven snow. And I thought, my God, is there any other resentments on here like that? And I looked at the Internal Revenue Service, and I said, now Charlie, forget them throwing you in jail. What did you do, if anything, to set that in motion? Well, hell, I cheated on my income tax. That's what I did. And they caught me. And they were about to throw me in jail. And I resented the hell out of them. And I played it over and over and over and over and over and made them worse and made me better and finally transferred all blame to them. Made me as pure as the driven snow. And of all the resentments that I had, I didn't find a one that I didn't do something to them to set it in motion in the first place. And it blew my mind. I never realized that's what I'd been doing. If you're a practicing alcoholic, hell, you've got to develop those kind of skills. I don't think you and I could live with ourselves if we had to honestly see what we're doing when we're out there doing our thing. But you see, we don't ever have to see it. Because we've got a little thing called resentments. We gradually transfer all blame to them, make ourselves as pure as the driven snow, and then we don't ever have to change ourselves, and we can keep right on doing the same things we've always done. And the end result is we go from man to man to man, from woman to woman to woman, from job to job to job, and it's always their damn fault. And we never have to change. And none of us are ever going to see that till we put this down on a sheet of paper. Now, my book also says, where had I been? Need you one more time, briefly. My book also says, where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, and inconsiderate? We didn't do your mother-in-law. Let's do his mother-in-law, and then we'll do column five. I'm sorry.
He forgets my mother-in-law.
He always used it to forget her, maybe.
What did I do? Through my drinking and the way I mistreated her daughter and her grandkids. I've been better off mistreating her. But I that's what I did. God, that's cold. And she retaliated to protect them. I set the ball rolling. Started the whole thing. But I use that as an excuse because I never would want to look out to own up to that. And I really needed that resentment.
Now, we go to the fifth column. And the fifth column says, where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate? Now, those are the basic character defects.
Which character defects cause us to do those things?
Those are the basic character defects which all human beings have, to one degree or another. All the other character defects that Bill mentions in the 12 and 12 and etc. stem from these. So I looked with this situation with Barbara. Where had I been selfish? Well, if I hadn't have been so selfish, I wouldn't have been out there doing those things I was doing. So selfishness is one of the things within me that caused that. If I hadn't have been so dishonest, I wouldn't have been sneaking around her back, behind her back, lying to her. So dishonesty is one of those things that caused that. If I hadn't have been saying to myself, now look, fella, you're getting to be about 40 years old. And if you're ever going to get any of that, you better get out there and do it now. Fear drives us and rules us and dominates us to do many things. If I hadn't been such a frightened individual, I might not have been doing that. If I had been more considerate of my wife and my children, I would have been paying more attention to what they need than what I needed. So inconsideration caused that too. And I began to see something in that fourth column I did not like. I began to see what I had become through my years of drinking.